So, to start this off, just for the record, this is Patrick Cook interviewing Elizabeth McNamer on the 6th. Is it the 6th?
It's the 5th.
It's the 5th, on the 5th of April, 2011, and also with us is cinematographer Matt Miller. So, to start this off, would you tell us your name and when and where you were born?
My name is Elizabeth McNamer, and I was born in Capawhite, County Tipperary, Ireland, in December of 1936.
And when did you move to the States?
Well, it's a long story when I left for the States. I grew up in Capawhite till I was 11 years old, and then I went to boarding school in England, place called Lowestoft in Suffolk, which accounts for my accent. I eventually came to America in 1959 and met my husband in Aspen, Colorado, and returned to Billings with him 3 days after I met him. And we've been married just about 50 years.
Wow. That's great. And how did you meet in Aspen?
Well, I'd been teaching in a school near Aspen, mm-hmm. and Bill was down there on a skiing trip. Huh. And I was about to leave the next day and go to Hong Kong. But instead, he persuaded me to come back to Montana and meet his family, which I did, and fell in love with all of them.
Wow. And when were you married?
We were married in May the 13th, 1961.
Hmm. That's great. So this, when did your ancestors leave Ireland, question is not applicable to you, because that was you mm-hmm. that left. What did your family do in Ireland? What were your... What was your father's profession?
Well, my father actually was in the British Army.
Oh.
And spent a lot of time in India. Mm. And then was retired by the time I was born and was living in Ireland. And my mother had a catering business, a very successful catering business in Ireland. But she died when I was 12 years old. I had four brothers. Three older than I, and Michael was younger, and eventually all of them left Ireland, and all of my brothers ended up here in America.
Hmm. And where in America did they?
Well, when I say America, Michael ended up in Canada, in Vancouver. He was a dentist there, and Frank and Patrick and Frederick ended up in California.
What do you know about your grandparents?
I know very little, really, about my grandparents because they had died quite a long while before I was born. In fact, it gets very, very complicated. My father was quite old when I was born, but when he was born, his father had already abandoned the family. He was a doctor. Mm. And had left Ireland and gone to Liverpool and married bigamously. Are you sure you want to hear all of this? And we knew very, very little about him. My father knew nothing about him until my brother Frank did a lot of research about 20 years ago, and we were able to find out about him. Mm. And, I mean, odd little coincidences happen. My maiden name was Forster, F-O-R-S-T-E-R. And a few years ago, I was in France and touring the battlefields of France. And I came across the graves of the unknown soldiers in Flanders Field. And looking at the list of the unknown soldiers, I saw the name Forster. And when I came home, I wrote to the Graves Commission at Ypres in Belgium and learned that the Forster was in fact my father's brother, whom he never knew.
Wow.
And who had died at the end of the First World War. But we never knew him. my mother's family were, my mother's maiden name was Shannon, and they came, her mother, whom I did know, my grandmother, was a Hogan from Ballyneety, famous for Sarsfield Rock. Sarsfield was a great Irish hero in the 1700s.
Okay, and that's why the name became so popular. We know there's been a handful of Sarsfields.
Sarsfields, yes, indeed. Yeah. Yes, that's true.
There was one, did you ever know?
Yes, Sarsfield Sullivan. Yes, indeed I did. A wonderful man.
Yeah.
Yes.
I didn't get to meet him, but we got some video tape of him.
Did you?
For the project.
Yes.
That's great. That's great. All right, we will move on. Is your husband of Irish ancestry?
He's of Irish ancestry, Okay. Yes. And that certainly influenced my choice.
Sure.
I'm quite sure that I would not have married somebody who wasn't Irish or of Irish ancestry.
Sure. Does he or you know much about his Irish ancestry? Where they...
Let's see, Bill was a lawyer here in Billings, and his mother's name was O'Shea from County Kerry, actually. And she was also of Irish ancestry. She wasn't born in Ireland, but certainly if you have any Irish in you, you have inherited a great deal of the culture and of Ireland.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. What did you bring with you from Ireland when you came to the...
Myself.
That was it?
Only.
It was a brave adventure.
A brave?
Striking out on your own.
No. Don't forget, my mother had died. My family had, in a way, disintegrated at that point, and... No, I wasn't really on my own. Well, I suppose I was on my own, yes, but I suppose I've always felt I had me with me, so I was all right. Wherever I went, I was a teacher, and I knew I could work wherever I went, and I have had the privilege of teaching most of my life.
Hmm. So do you speak any languages other than English?
Well, Irish, of course, I grew up with, and then French and Latin.
Wow.
And, of course, I mean, I've studied other languages to some extent, but don't speak them.
Sure.
Yes, Greek and a little Hebrew and a little Russian, but I don't speak them, no.
Sure.
No.
Impressive, nonetheless.
It is.
Oh.
Well, I teach religious studies, so that would account for a smattering of...
Greek and Hebrew. Mm-hmm. The Latin, of course.
Latin, of course, we had to have at school in England to get into a college. You had to have an ancient and a modern language.
Okay. What are some memories of your childhood? Yeah. Anything that... anything.
Well... Ireland, Cap of White. To me, it was always, the sun was always shining. In fact, I know it wasn't because it rains in Ireland so much of the time.
Right.
We're told in school in Ireland, the climate of Ireland is mild, genial and salubrious, which means it rains constantly. I have lovely memories of growing up in Cap o' White, and we had chickens and a cow and pigs, and I still actually have chickens here.
Really?
I raise chickens. They're not here at the moment. They're on a farm up in Absorkey, but they will come back at Easter.
Sure.
And of course I have a rooster right here behind.
I see.
Behind me. But and I know that my brother in California keeps donkeys because it reminds him of Ireland and maybe what we grew up with.
What sort of things would you do to occupy your time when you were a child? What sort
when
of
I
games?
Was a child, mm-hmm. Of course, you know, there are no heated houses, and so every room has a fireplace in Ireland. And you might even notice in my house, I have how many fireplaces? 1, 2, 3, 4 fireplaces, because this is what one makes one feel cozy and at home.
Yeah.
And so often reading. My father, as I say, had spent a great deal of time in India, and he was a wonderfully cultured and charming man. And sitting at the fire with my father, hearing stories of India for the most part, and the British Army and the British Empire. And we did a great deal of reading.
Do you remember any of the stories that he told you? Any that stick out particularly?
That he told me many of the stories. Well, upstairs I have a beautiful counterpane for a bed, which I keep up in the attic, that is made by women in Kashmir, handmade by women in Kashmir, and it's absolutely beautiful. And he told me about the gardens of Shalimar, where I think he probably had an affair with somebody or other, because he used to sing a song called Pale Hands I See Beside the Shalimar. And, you know, he was part of the Raj. Now that I know a little more and have read more, I realize how difficult this actually was. You know, the British Army sent over only officers to train the Indian men. And he told me once about being stationed on the borders between Afghanistan and what is now Bangladesh. No, what is now Pakistan.
Okay.
And being alone there, and the fear that he felt being alone there. Of course, you know, at that point, none of us knew where. We'd never heard of Afghanistan and things like that. Now I can realize what it must have been like for him. He told once of a bear trying to get in his window.
This is great. This is fantastic. Do you remember any of the games you played when you were a child?
Well, of course, we played Tig. You know what Tig is.
I don't.
You chase each other around. My brothers played hurling. Of course, I had four brothers, and what the boys did was much more important than what the girls did. And we had to watch hurling games ad infinitum. One of my brothers still plays rugby at the age of 75.
Really?
Yes. He goes all over the world to play rugby. So this was very important, but for girls it wasn't. Running, I still run. I ran 4 miles this morning.
Really?
But we did a lot of running around in Ireland. And we played Tig, you know, you touch somebody and then you go and hide and seek and all of those usual stuff. And I remember now and again there would be maybe a stray goat who walked through the streets and we'd all chase after the goat and things like that. Not terribly impressive, I must say. But I do remember once playing Tig down by the parochial hall when somebody came and said, "Hitler is dead." And I stopped everything and ran home to tell my father, because my father, you know, was terribly interested in the war. Of course, he already had the news. We had the only radio set in Capelwhite, and people used to gather round it to hear the news of the war. And that has somehow or other stayed in my memory, the death of Hitler. It was going to make a big difference in our lives. I remember just very vaguely at the beginning of the war, them removing all of the signs that indicated where places were, just in case the Germans should land in Capelwhite and come down the hill road and be able to see where places were.
So they would be and, severely inconvenienced.
Yes, and they even removed the sign from outside our school. saying it was Kappa White Girls National School, was removed so the Germans would be really confused. Not that any Germans ever did arrive.
Right. That's so interesting.
Yes, I do remember once hearing a plane go over. And of course, this was long before there were any planes. And everybody very confused about what it was. And I don't know what it was. Maybe it was a German plane that had gone astray or something. Mm. But talking about planes, my uncle arrived back from America on one of the very first planes to go into Shannon Airport on a Pan Am plane that came in 1946. And at that point, we didn't know what time the plane would arrive, just that he would be there. But we all got up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I think he arrived about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. it was 12 hours later. But I do remember the opening. It was called Rhinanna then, and now, of course, it's called Shannon. And in fact, I'm flying in there myself this summer.
That's fantastic. Yeah. How often do you make it back?
Not very often, no. This year I have to go to England. I'm giving a talk at a conference in London. Oh. And then I will go from there to Ireland. I go every year to Israel. I am a director of an archaeological dig there at Bethsaida. So I go there every year to do that. And that seems to be where I go, rather than go to Ireland.
Yeah. That's really interesting. What are you finding at the dig in
Bethsaida? Good Lord, how many hours do you have?
Oh, gosh.
Bethsaida is a place frequently associated with the ministry of Jesus. And five of the apostles, possibly as many as eight, came from here, which, of course, is my main interest in it. But the talk I'll be giving in London is called From Artifact to Text. What I will be giving in this talk is relating the things we have found to the words of Jesus. Mm. For instance, we know about fishing. Well, we know that that was all of the fishing equipment that we have found. Mm-hmm. How did Jesus cure people? We don't know, but we have found a number of implements used by doctors. There was a doctor living in Bethsaida. Hmm. We have found that. He cured the blind man at Bethsaida. Still don't know how he managed that, though. I've talked to a number of ophthalmologists who have visited our site who tell me that you could actually remove cataracts from people's eyes even at that time, and that many babies were actually born with cataracts. And how he did it, I don't know. But we've found lots of pottery, loads of... we know they made their own wine. We found wine cellars. Hmm. They made bread, of course, and how they ground it. And very, very difficult for a woman to feed a family, say, of six, would have taken her about 3 hours a day just to make the bread. Hmm. She'd have to grind everything up. And how long it took to make everything, how they made clothes, we found all of this. And it fits in with the words of Jesus. Anyway, that's the talk I'll be giving in London.
Have you found the pools? Have the original pools been found?
We do have two little springs at Bethsaida, but Bethsaida was right on the Sea of Galilee. Fishing was the main industry.
Right.
And in fact, what surprised us, I think, about it was that the fishermen were not poor. You know, we're often led to believe that only the poor follow Jesus. They were middle-class businessmen, one could say.
Sure.
We have found that some of them were importing their wine from as far away as the island of Rhodes. It would be like saying somebody living in Billings was getting their wine from Burgundy. You're not living on the edge. We found golden earrings. Well, we've never found a pair, but we have found that they could afford to give their wives beautiful jewelry. Hmm. They weren't living on the edge, and they had quite comfortable houses.
That's fascinating.
So that's one of the things we're finding, of course. I mean, fish was the main source of protein in Israel at this time. They ate very little meat. It was usually used for temple sacrifice in Jerusalem.
That's great. All right, so back to childhood. Just a couple more questions about that, and then we'll move on. Did you have any particular toys that you remember growing up?
Dolls.
Dolls.
Lots of dolls.
And were they
I love to play house, and I still do. You can probably tell from looking around.
You've accessorized this house.
Well, I've tried in a way to bring Ireland over here since I don't have it, and England too, of course, because I spent a great deal of my time in England.
And I think you've done a great job.
And what's going to happen to it all now? I don't know. Bill and I have 5 children, and they don't live here. Well, my daughter Deirdre lives in Red Lodge. She practices medicine there. Okay. And my son Bruce and 2 of my daughters live in Washington, D.C. And Bridget lives in California. So none of them lives here,
right,
which is a dreadful pity.
Yeah. Yeah?
That's life.
What do the other children do?
Bruce runs a company called TechnoServe, and essentially what they do is go into little impoverished villages in the third world and get them started in business. Oh. It's a wonderful thing, extremely successful. He'll send somebody, it's not amateur by any means. I mean, they send in MBAs from Stanford to get them started in their businesses, and suddenly you'll find this little village is employing 400 people to export their tea or their bananas or whatever the heck it is. But it's been extremely successful. TechnoServe, he has said that the real difference between their lack of progress and ours was that they weren't technologically competent to take care of things. That's why it's called TechnoServe. But that's what Bruce does.
That's
and Bill Gates just gave his company something like 250 million. People are very impressed by what's happening there. Then Sarah teaches in Georgetown. And teaches medieval studies. And then Amy is a lawyer in Washington. And Bridget works for the Skoll Foundation in California. And in a way that's involved very much, like Bruce is, in awarding grants to entrepreneurs in the third world.
Wow. It sounds like you've raised a lot of successful children.
Well, we never know really what success is, do we? You never really know what is what, but they're all quite fortunate and doing well.
Sounds
doing
like
good. They're doing good things.
Yes.
Yes.
That's great. We've talked a little bit about what your house was like growing up, but how many were in your household?
I told you, I think I had 4 brothers.
Right.
And of course, my mother had a catering business, so we had people around there the whole time. She used to cater things at distant places. I mean, she would say, cater a supper at a dance that was being given in Cork City, which was 60 miles away. And she would have to take everything with her to do this. She was a tremendous woman and had employed most of the village in her catering business. So after her death, I'm afraid a lot of people were out of work.
What kind of chores did you have around the house?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was always somebody who'd do the stuff. We did have maids, which was quite usual in that time. But nonetheless, because I was a girl and the only one in four boys, then I was expected to do a lot of things, which I loved to do. my parents collected antiques, wonderful things that many of them my father had brought back from India and from China. Invaluable things. I mean, when we sold our house in Ireland, people from museums all over Europe came to buy the stuff. But I had to learn how to dust all of these things. And I don't know that I was really assigned any, but I was very industrious and liked to help. And as I say, I love to play house anyway. Right. So
so it wasn't too much of a burden?
No, no, I wouldn't say I was overburdened at anything.
So did you go to university?
In London. Yes, yes, yes. And became a teacher.
Right.
And I have taught ever since.
Gosh.
Well, I mean, I did take time off when my children were little.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as Deirdre went to first grade, I went back part-time to teaching.
Do you, who do you stay in touch with in Ireland still? Do you have childhood friends or anything?
That's interesting because I'm going there this summer and I will be staying with a friend. Well, of course, I'll go to Dublin because I love Dublin anyway. But I will go to Capelquite, and my friend said, who would you like to see? And I said, everybody I was in school with. And so she's trying to arrange a reunion of all the people that I knew when I was 5 or 6.
Sure.
And
great.
Of course, you really hardly remember who they are, but
right.
We'll see when we get there. Yes.
Was your family Irish Catholic?
Oh, of course.
Yes.
Oh, yes, yes, Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I've been Catholic all my life. I love the church. Go to Mass every day, all my life.
Mm-hmm. And that was the same with your parents? That was something that they handed down
to
you?
No, not particularly. Well, I mean, they weren't particularly religious. They were both Catholic.
Mm.
I don't know where I got it from, but I remember when I was 4 years old, saying I'd like to go to Mass. And then when I made my first Holy Communion when I was 6, determining I would go to Mass every day as long as I lived.
Hmm.
And it hasn't been possible, of course, but for the most part it has. So, yes, I am Catholic.
And so what...
And so is my husband. Of course, I would not have married somebody who wasn't.
So what... festivals and holidays did your
well of course we had Christmas and Easter and mm-hmm. Whitsun, Pentecost and St. Patrick's Day, but it was a religious holiday and there would usually be a dance in the evening. The
mm-hmm.
Irish are great dancers. Might have seen River Dance.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes.
But they love to dance and certainly wasn't celebrated like it is in America. I just always find it a little bit annoying with the green beer and all of this stuff because
yeah.
We never celebrated it like that. No, we would go out and gather the shamrock and because it only grows in Ireland
mm-hmm.
and we would wear that or something.
And did you dance a lot growing up?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Still do.
Do you?
But I won't do it right now.
Fair enough. Fair enough. That's great. What have you noticed that has changed between those holidays and how they're celebrated in Ireland and how they're celebrated
well,
here?
I see. Well, I mean, Christmas, for instance, when I was a child, children would get something from Father Christmas, Santa Claus. But we didn't have Christmas trees, and usually there weren't gifts, you know, there weren't, no, it was a religious holiday. It was beautiful, beautiful, but we didn't have trees, but we did have holly. We'd go and collect holly, and we'd always have a turkey and whatever else. People baked their turkeys in the local bakery. We had two bakeries and you couldn't very well cook a turkey at home over a turf fire. Maybe you could. So they would take them to the local bakery to have them have the turkey done. It was wonderful. And we had a lot of stuff to eat. Now, don't forget that when I was a child, food was fairly scarce. There wasn't the preponderance of food that we have here now. I mean, we would be suggested that we take less of this and less of that and not have stuff pushed at you. But at Christmas, there was always Christmas cake. I wrote a little article which Billings Gazette published this Christmas on Christmas in Capelwhite and what I remember about it. And the baking of the Christmas cake was always wonderful just before Christmas, a couple of months. And when you baked it, you always put in a shilling and or a halfpenny, if that's all you had. And you put in money and you put in a thimble and you put in a ring. And then you stirred it. And whoever found the ring when it was cut at Christmas would be married that year. And whoever found the thimble would work hard that year. And whoever found the money would become rich. And I remember once stirring the Christmas cake, and there was a competition in a woman's magazine as to what you would wish for when you stirred the Christmas cake. And I asked my mother, well, what should I wish for? And she said, why don't you wish for good health so that you can enjoy eating it? So I wrote that and I won half a crown. How's that?
That's great.
But we would wake up on Christmas morning and find a few toys. There were some people who didn't have toys. I remember one Christmas, one of my friends I met at Mars hadn't got anything from Father Christmas. And I went home and told my mother. And she said to me, you know, I think Santa Claus made a mistake because you have a doll just like that from last year. I think he intended it for the girl up the hill road. And so my brother was sent up the hill road with the doll and a note to say that Santa Claus had made a mistake.
Oh, that's awesome. Wow. Have you been, and you've been back to your hometown since?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do go back. Yes.
What sort of changes?
We had, you know, we used to do a lot of singing and dancing and playing the piano. In our house, we had five pianos.
In your house?
Five children, yes. And we had five pianos so that everybody could play the piano. And anyway, we did an awful lot of singing, a great deal of singing. Every evening, that's how you entertained yourself or entertained each other. You sang.
Sure. That's great. Have you noticed in your trips back, have you noticed any changes to the neighborhood?
Oh, of course. Television changed everything. people used to go to each other's houses to visit each other's houses. We used to call it, in Irish, it's called going a cordie, just means to talk. And now they stay home and watch television. And that has made an awful lot of difference. I think it has isolated people who weren't isolated before. I mean, as a child, I could run into anybody's house and did. And sometimes you'd expect to be fed there. I mean, if they were eating, you'd eat with them. And this was how things were done. But it's not like that any longer. No, of course, Ireland went through its time of, what do they call it, the Celtic Tiger. And I think that ruined things for people too, when they were overly rich.
Yeah. What does the community do for, what are the main employments now in the community?
Well, I'm not sure now. When I was a child, of course, my father ran the LDF, which was the local defense force. And that was because it was during the war and used to parade the soldiers up and down the Chapel Lane We all learned how to march left, right, left, right, left, right. And my mother ran the Red Cross when they used to meet in the parochial hall, and they would make wine bandages for the soldiers to be sent to the front and make socks for the soldiers and things like this.
Wow.
And then, of course, there was the hurling team. Nearly everything was around hurling and football and stuff like that.
Right.
There was nothing for girls. Oh, yes, my mother then started a tennis club, built a tennis court that everybody could use. And we played tennis as children. And
sure. What places stand out most in your mind in the village?
What places in the village? Well, the church, of course, because we went there a lot. And in fact, in my living room, I have a little something from the church, which used to be read in the mornings, on Sunday mornings at Mass. And the school. The school was just, they had the boys' school and then the girls' school. And there were two classrooms. A classroom for the low infants, the high infants, and the first and second class. And then the next room was for the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth class. And that's all. Then when you'd reach the sixth class, this was government sponsored, but after that there were no free high schools.
Wow.
This was only available in Ireland in 1969. So anyone wanting to go on to secondary school had to go to boarding school if their parents could afford it. And of course, all my brothers went to boarding school. They went to Rockwell College. And I was sent to school in England.
Hmm.
So.
Wow. And how was what was that like being away from your family for that long?
Well, I don't know. I often remember, you know, I had to get on, here I was 11, I was put on a train in Tipperary. I knew I had to get out at Dublin, and I had my suitcases for a year, just one suitcase. And then I had to get a taxi across Dublin, and then get a train out to Dunleary, where the boat docked, and then take the boat across the Irish Sea, and land in Holyhead, and then take a train, 8 hours train ride to London, get a taxi across London to Liverpool Street, and take a train up to Lowestoft, and then a taxi from there to the convent, St. Mary's Convent. And all I remember about it is taking the train from Holyhead down to London. There wasn't a seat to sit on, it was 8 hours. And we got on the train at midnight, and I remember sitting on my suitcase in the corridor and being terrified I'd break my suitcase. I remember that quite distinctly. But was I homesick? Well, strange, because I was Irish and had an Irish accent. I was sort of something to be laughed at. So strange. I mean, my accent now, of course, is English, because I stood before an elocution teacher for hours on end until I couldn't pronounce anything with an Irish accent any longer, and had to pronounce them in the accent I now have. And of course, we didn't learn Irish in England. I also found that in school in England, I was about 2 years ahead of everybody else as far as other things, mathematics. We'd learned French through Irish and the sort of thing. So I was way ahead of them in most subjects. But there was a sort of general feeling in England at that time that if you're Irish, you're stupid or something. So especially with my accent, well, anyway, I was quite determined they would soon learn. And I remember the first day in class, Sister St. Aidan giving me a poem, giving everybody a poem to learn by heart, The Lady of Shalott. And I took it and I learnt it, and I raised my hand and said, Sister, I know it. And she said, you couldn't, you're Irish. And she said, well, say it. So I did. Everybody else was still on the first verse trying to learn it, but I'd learned all 32 verses or whatever and still remember it.
You still remember the whole
thing? Yes, yes. On either side of the river lie long fields of barley and of rye that clothe the world and reach the sky. And through the field a road runs by to many towered Camelot. And up and down the people go, etc., etc. So I think from then on they decided to just throw everything at me and have me learn it by heart, including Caesar's Gallic Wars. In Latin, which was a little silly, but anyway, I love the English and grew to love them, and they me, and I will be going back to see many of my friends there this summer.
That's great. That's great. Does your family have any special sayings or expressions?
There were all sorts of peculiar expressions you had in Cup of White, which really didn't have anything to do with anything. But I still use them to some extent. You know, if somebody's spending too much money, you're being too flahuluk. Flahuluk just means, and I'll use that sometimes. I can't remember what the equivalent of it is in American. And my children, of course, understand, but people
being
don't.
Being wasteful?
Yes, yes, being wasteful. Flahuluk, yes, yes, yes. Or, oh, he's quite an omadorn. Omadorn meaning a little stupid, an omadorn. Or if it's a woman, an onchuk. Onchuk. Would you understand if I said somebody's just a bit of an onchuk?
Probably not. But I might use that in passing conversation now.
You might. Okay, all right. And see what happens. But there were a lot of things that had a lot of historical value in Cup of White, say, but they wouldn't be understood outside. For instance, you say, where is she? Where is somebody? And the response you would get is, hiding a beyond in Murray's pig house. Well, you wouldn't understand what that meant. But apparently a long time ago, there was somebody who was running away from the law. And that's where they were found, hiding in Murray's pig house. Well, you couldn't be bothered to answer. I mean, people say to me, oh, well, where is Bill? I'll say, oh, hiding a beyond in Murray's pig house. It means nothing. Things like that. You used expressions in Cap of White like two people look alike. You say, he's the very same as if you've cut the head off him, as if they have the same head.
Yeah.
Silly things like that.
That's great.
Yes.
I think we've covered that. What family heirlooms or keepsakes do you have?
Well, of course, when I left Ireland, I was going back to school in England and couldn't find anything. But I did find one beautiful little, which I stuck in my pocket, a lovely little pocket book that dated back to 1710. Which I took with me. 1710. I wish I could show it to you now, but I gave it to my son Bruce for his birthday, his 40th birthday. So I don't have that. But when I was back in Ireland a few years ago, visiting people, some of them gave me stuff that belonged to my grandmother. I've got a little lamp in there over my fireplace that I light every night in memory of my grandmother, because it came from her house, and I say a little prayer for my grandmother. And just a couple of things like that, but there's really not very much that I was able to take with me.
I see a helmet behind you here.
That actually is from, I'm very interested in war, maybe because of my father, but that helmet comes from the Normandy beaches.
Wow.
Yes. You want to see it?
Sure, yeah.
And when I was in Normandy a few years ago, here we are. Now, I had thought to myself, well, look, it looks so new. And anyway, one day here, a few years ago, a gentleman came in and he looked at this and he says, and he was German, and he had been in Hitler's youth. Mm. And he said to me, "Oh my God, you've got a genuine German helmet." And I said, "But look, it's so new." And he said, "That proves it came from Normandy, because practically everybody, every German on the northern or on the that border were all very young. They were new recruits." Mm. He was about to be recruited and he was 12.
Oh my goodness.
So, well, I don't say they were all age 12, but they were calling up boys who were very young. Anyway, this here also is part of a cannon from Normandy.
Oh my goodness.
Yes. Normally I have sunflowers in it. I don't have right now, but they used to put a sunflower on the German graves. Hmm. When a soldier died, they would put sunflowers on his grave.
Hmm. So interesting. Hmm. Wow, this is an incredible condition.
Yes. You want to try it on?
That's all right. It's heavy too.
Yes.
Can you imagine walking around with this on your head for hours on end?
Oh, I know. I just don't know how they did it. But every time I touch it, I pray for the soldier who probably was killed wearing this. Mm. It's quite an emotional experience to go back and look at those graves.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Germans, Americans, English, everybody who was killed there. Awful. Mm. I took a boat over from Portsmouth over to Normandy just to sort of reenact the experience of D-Day. Mm-hmm. But, of course, I didn't have to get off a boat and start shooting.
Sure.
Or be shot at.
What was the approach like, though? I mean, what kind of thoughts were going through your head when you were...
I could think of... Actually, on the boat, they showed the movie The Longest Day.
Oh.
And which was about the Normandy invasion. And, oh, God, I just can't imagine it. I think that I was able to understand why so very few soldiers want to talk about their experience in the war. Mm. Very few. Because I realized they were all terrified. Everyone was frightened. We keep thinking these brave soldiers going on. My God, you've come over that four-hour trip. You're all crowded together. You're wet from, it was raining and wet from the sea. And then having to jump off into the sea and run onto the beaches where so many of them were instantly shot. And if you weren't, you could go further along. What it must have been like. Mm. Frightful, frightful thing. So people were very frightened. I collect war stories when I can, and it's interesting.
Have you made any sort of collection of those stories?
No, they're all in my head. It's one of the things I'm promising to do is to get them written down. But you know, a few years ago here, somebody turned up. He was driving a car, and our friends up the street, Christine Swady and her husband, saw them, and they asked directions to go to a hotel. And Tony and Christina, being the people they are, said, "We'll take you there." So they took them because they realized their English was very poor. Mm. And they were Italian, and the man said that he had come here because he had known an American soldier during the war and he was trying to find him. Well, anyway, Christina Swady invited them for dinner, and then she came over and asked me if I had anything in the refrigerator and we could get dinner for them, which we did.
Yeah.
And they came over, and this man came from Milan, and he told the story that when he was a boy, he had found a downed American plane. Wow. And he had pulled the pilot out of it, and he had hidden him, because we were at loggerheads with Italians and Americans. He had hidden him, and then, because he was wounded, he had taken care of him. and then he had eventually led him over the mountains into Switzerland to safety. But that he knew nothing about him. He used to call him G.I., and that he came from Terry, Montana. That's all he knew, because they didn't speak each other's language. And he had come back to see if he could find him in Terry, Montana. Well, after a lot of we looked into this, it turns out that the man that he thought he had rescued could have been him, had been killed in the Korean War. So he never did meet him. But there are stories abounding like that. I was telling this to some people in England, and one man there said, well, I was downed over Germany, and I was rescued. All of the others in the plane were killed. I was rescued by a German family who took me to their home, and the mother took me in and fed me a wonderful meal. And then she took a picture from the sideboard and said, my Fritz, my son is in the army too. And brought the little girls down to meet me. But that they had to hand me over the next day. They couldn't keep me. I had to. So he'd spent the rest of the war in a prisoner of war camp. But he was going to then go back and see if he could find that family after I told him this story. There are a lot of these things hanging around. Okay, but they've got nothing whatever to do with Ireland, of course.
Sure, but if at any point you want to do a separate project, I'll come back and record those, because that would be incredible. Think about it. But I think we've got a few more questions here. And
yeah.
Then maybe. And then we'll maybe do a quick look about.
Yes, okay.
And then we'll leave you to your afternoon.
Well, yeah.
This is really fantastic. Thank you. So we've talked a little bit about cultural traditions, but
yes.
Do you remember anything like wakes?
Any
wakes in the family?
Wakes?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. And, you know, there's a great deal of misunderstanding, I think, in America about an Irish wake.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody dies, my God, you don't go in rejoicing, drinking. I've heard of all of this, and it just infuriates me. That isn't the case. I remember seeing my first dead body when I was about 4. It was a young woman, aged 25, who'd been ill all of her life. I'd never known her until, and we used to go and see the body. That's what you did. And you knelt by the body and you prayed, and the body wasn't all done up. You saw a dead person, and they looked dead and looked terrible. But there were candles by the bedside, and there would be some people there standing in the room and crying. And then when you came downstairs, you would be sympathizing with, and sometimes you'd be offered a drink. People didn't have, normally they didn't have drink in the home. If people wanted to drink, they went to the pubs.
Yeah.
But we're led to believe that there was all of this carousing and everything else, which is not the case. My God, I remember my mother, seeing my mother laid out, and last thing you would have, I mean, nobody is that insensitive. But so I don't know why they talk about Irish wakes. Maybe it's something different happens in America. I don't know.
Mm.
But I never saw it happen in Ireland. You have a mother dying in childbirth. I remember going out to see her, because children go as well to pray. And she had 7 other children that were left there. Well, is it likely that people are going to go in and start? They will go in and try to help in whatever way they can.
Mm.
Like we do here in America, when we hear somebody's died, we go to the home and take food and do whatever we can. to help with the situation, but
sure. Right.
You know, there are a lot of misunderstandings about Ireland. Oh, my God, it used to drive me up the wall when people would tell me these Pat and Mike jokes that I had no idea what they were talking about. And when they would see me say top of the morning, which is an expression I never heard in Ireland, and they presumed that I related to them somehow or other, or they talk about lace curtain Irish. I had no idea what the heck that meant. It had nothing whatever to do with the culture in which I grew up.
Mm. Interesting. Were there any... what's that? Oh, yeah.
The nurse upstairs giving my husband a shower.
Oh, okay. Okay. Do you recall any superstitions?
Yes. Pishogues. You know what pishogues are?
No.
People who want to put a curse on other people. They might put a piece of raw meat out on the hedge. And you know it's pishogues somebody's been doing, trying to put a curse on that house. Or something like that. Now and again you'd see something like that and you'd say, well, that's a pishogue. Somebody's... We also had a belief in the banshee. You know what the banshee is?
Mm-hmm.
It's an old woman with long hair who's always combing her long hair. And when the banshee cries outside your house, somebody's going to die. Mm-hmm. And I remember our maids in Kapawai who were in charge of my young brother and I, trying to get us to go to sleep at night and telling us if we didn't, the banshee would arrive. I don't know how that was supposed to get you to sleep.
It's terrifying.
Terrifying. And my brother Freddie found a comb out in our backyard, so it was an indication that the banshee had actually been there. I did believe strongly in ghosts, yes. You know, Ireland is such a tragic history, and everywhere you go, something terrible has happened. You know that. Somebody's been murdered. You go down to see a friend in Chadville House, and you know that there's a bullet hole through the front door where they shot at the landlord there too. I don't know if they killed him or just tried to kill him, but you had an awful lot of tragedy, and so we had ghosts everywhere. And I was terrified of ghosts as a child. In fact, even when I came to America, I still was. I was frightened to go out at night because I might meet a ghost. It took me a while to get over that.
Hmm. Wow.
Now I'm not afraid of ghosts any longer. In fact, I'd like to meet one.
Do you still partake in any traditions of Irish origin, such as, well,
there isn't anything here in Billings.
Sure.
We don't have anything. On St. Patrick's Day, of course, I have a party here, and I do bring my my friends in, and we sing a great deal. My father was in school with the great tenor John McCormick. He was a great Irish tenor, and I remember sitting on his knee in our house in Kapawhite once, just very, very vaguely remember this. And we have lots of John McCormick's records here, which we listen to. But really, there isn't anything. There are people of Irish descent, but I have very few friends. The Irish priests, of course, we have... Father Houlihan, Father O'Gorman, Father Hogan, Father Harney, Father Keane, who are all Irish, and I love that, to be with them. And I make Irish soda bread. I make Irish stew and this sort of thing. But there isn't an Irish community here. I think in Butte there is, but not here in Billings. I don't know anybody else in Billings who is Irish. My friend Valerie Hemingway comes down, and I see Valerie quite often, and I'm always so happy to see her because we speak the same language. We know where we're coming from. She understands, and I understand. If she uses expressions, I understand them. So does she.
That's great.
Yes. So I'm very comfortable being with the Irish. Sister Valerie lives up the street here, Sister Valerie Keogh. She was here for dinner the other night, and you just feel at home with the Irish.
Were there any traditional cures for common ailments in your home?
For which?
For ailments of any kind, any traditional?
Yes. We would be given a little hot milk with Guinness. to put us to sleep, or a little hot Irish whiskey when we were really sick, in tea with honey, which was a very nice remedy and probably still is for everything. Occasionally when one of my children comes home and they're just exhausted from something, I just send them up to bed and I take them up a nice hot cup of tea with a little whiskey and honey.
I know my mother certainly implemented that.
Did she?
Yes.
Yes. And we constantly keep Irish whiskey in the house here. Powers whiskey. My father liked Powers whiskey. And in fact, James Joyce, when he was living in France, whenever anyone from Ireland came to visit him, he always requested they bring some Powers Irish whiskey with them.
And can you get that?
Yes.
In
the States? You can get it here. Yes.
Okay.
You can get it here in Billings.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Last couple of questions, and then we'll leave you to your day. What are some of the most striking changes in your life so far?
Striking changes in my life.
Since you've.
Well, it was a great change going to school in England, and then a great change living in America. I never planned on living in America. I'm a citizen of Ireland and England and America, all three places. And, you know, there's a lovely poem by Alice Duer Miller, who was an American who lived in England during the First World War. But she has lovely lines that go, I was now of that unhappy few who lose the old but never gain the new, however faithful and however true to my new country, I could never be an American. I mean, she says, never an Englishwoman, but I can never be truly American. Anytime I go into the grocery store, I come out and, oh, where are you from? Oh, yes, my great-grandparents were from wherever. you're always a foreigner.
Right.
No matter how hard you try to accommodate, not that, Americans are wonderful people, but I'm always a foreigner. I haven't had this childhood experience that they have had. I mean, I remember when my son came home from school and said he was going to the prom. And to me, the prom was a place you walked along by the sea wall in Lowestoft. And he needed a new suit. I didn't know why you needed a new suit to go to a prom. Sarah came home and said she was a cheerleader. I had no idea what the heck a cheerleader was, but she was going to be a cheerleader. Well, what the heck is a cheerleader? I remember once going into a house in Helena, and it was very soon after I got here, Bill was in the legislature, and the woman saying to me, my son is only a sophomore, but he's already playing basketball, varsity basketball. I didn't know what a sophomore was. I didn't know what varsity was. I didn't know what basketball was. I concluded, well, sophomoric, it probably means he's stupid. basketball. Well, girls play netball in England, varsity. I couldn't make out. So I decided he was a sort of sissy who played girls' games and wasn't very bright. You see? But in many ways, even though I've been here a long time, some things will come up like this that I simply, it's not part of my background, and I don't understand it.
That's interesting. So if you were to write the history of the Irish in Montana, what do you think would be important?
Well, I did it. At one point, I did research the history in Montana, and I think I sent it on to Bernadette of what the Irish had done. You know, there used to be a saying, those with any get up and go have gone. So many of those who came over, that people who came directly over, had what it takes to leave behind everything you've loved and know you'll never go back there again. That really takes a lot of gumption. And How would I write about it? Well, these were extraordinary people. They wanted to create their own community. And of course, in Butte, they had such an opportunity to do that because there were so many of them who came over. If you remember that history, the history there of Daly, Marcus Daly, sending boats over to Ireland to collect people to work in the mines in Butte. So they created an Irish community, but they were involved in every single aspect of life here in Montana. And, you know, you don't have that many Irish coming any longer, but we did have an awful lot of Irish priests coming over. They were missionaries who were trained in Thurles, in the seminary in Thurles. They came over here, and the last one to come was my cousin, Father Hogan, and that was in 1965, but we haven't had any coming since then. I mean, there hasn't been the immigration from Ireland that there was in my young day. Everybody had to leave Ireland, more or less. There was nothing for them to do there. There was very little work for them to do. People were leaving in droves and going to work in England. So if I were writing a history of the Irish in Montana, they were people with a great deal of drive and intelligence and charm, of course, who got things done. And without the Irish in Montana, I don't know where we would be. In the legislature, you think of our first governor. He was an acting governor, Maher. Incidentally, I met his great grandson in Jerusalem several years ago, Declan Maher and his charming wife. He's a doctor in Dublin, and he'd gone over after he retired to help out in Bethlehem delivering babies. And he found the need was so great there, he had to stay there for 12 years. Anyway, I met him, and there's a book written about Maher and all of his, six of his contemporaries who were part of an Irish uprising in 1854, and they were all condemned to death. And at the trial, the judge said, "Do you have anything to say before you're executed?" And Francis Maher spoke up and said, "Judge, just give us one more chance and we won't fail." But anyway, it was commuted to life imprisonment and they were sent to Australia. And I've been to Australia to see where he went, Maher. But he escaped. All of them escaped. They were sent to Australia. You know, that was the place where the prison ships, they had all of these ships out on the coast. They didn't have enough room in the prisons in England or Ireland to keep everybody, so they had to send them to Australia. He went on prison ship and went over there. They all escaped, and all of them became either presidents of countries or governors, all of them, all six. Well, it's just that sort of drive is in the Irish. I am going to succeed. I had some of it myself when I went to school in England. I'll show them. this sort of thing. Hmm. And we've had that. We've had that spirit in Montana.
That's right.
Of, yes, I will succeed. I won't fail.
Hmm. That's great. And that is my last question.
And that's it?
That is it.
Oh, okay.
Thank you so much.
Oh, well, would this was fun.
Would you mind, I don't know where we're at time-wise.
Almost 10:30.
Okay.
Oh, Lord, you don't have much time. I mean, when Deirdre was a baby, was little, I had a dollhouse made for her, and it's like an Irish cottage, but that's upstairs in the attic.
Oh.
Okay. There's a bedroom up there for my children.
Well, maybe we could just have you show us the plaque that you were showing me earlier.
Yeah, okay.
The lab. And then we'll pack things up.
Yeah, okay. All right. And all of these are sort of English-Irish, as you can see.
Sure. And your collection of pots and pans is fantastic.
I bought those in France.
They're fantastic.
I do a lot of cooking. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see in here. My water of a chandelier comes from Ireland. I once owned a house in Ireland, which I sold, and with whatever money I had left over, I bought my chandelier.
It's beautiful.
It is beautiful, isn't it?
Yes.
And of course I have all Waterford crystal stuff and all of that.
Hmm.
Okay.
Hi.
Well, hi, Will.
Hello.
Oh, we've got everybody. And Deirdre's here. Hi, love.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Nice to meet
I'm
you.
I'm Bill.
I'm Patrick Cook.
Patrick.
Nice to meet you, sir.
Hi there. And I'm
Patrick.
His therapist, so
all right.
I'm kind of working
we'll
him over.
We'll get
him.
Out of your way
I'm
here.
Hi, Bill.
Nice to meet
you.
Hi,
you? Good. How are you?
This is my daughter,
Patrick
Deirdre.
Cook. Nice
Deirdre,
to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Yes.
We just
hi,
had a
Deirdre. Nice to
yeah.
see you.
Had a little chat.
Yes.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
And
an
we're,
interview?
Well, this is Zoe.
Yeah.
How old is Zoe?
She's 8 months old.
So cute.
Yes, so she's a little doll. And look, she's got Irish buttons.
Yeah. My sister has a little girl that's
is that
same
right?
Age.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Does she?
Mm-hmm.
Huh, huh, huh. And this is my husband.
Yeah, I met
yep.
them.
We just met
are you
this
a
is
local?
No,
we're
they come from Missoula.
We're from the university.
They're doing
Missoula.
A project
mm-hmm.
in Missoula on the Irish in Montana.
Yeah.
I told you about
good.
That.
Good.
And Bernadette Sweeney. And,
mm-hmm.
Bernadette Sweeney's in charge of it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what we were looking for
oh, yeah.
was this over here. And let's
so
see.
We can go back out here if you like.
Sure, here, sure. move this over. This, of course, is an Irish cross. Okay. Here we are. This comes from my church in Capel White. And it's from the opening of the Gospel of John. In principo erat verbum, et verbum erat apud Deum, et Deus erat verbum. Hoc erat in principo apud Deum, omnia per ipsum facta sunt, etc., etc. And this used to be read at Mass.
Mm.
It isn't any longer. That old church fell down, and one of my brothers collected stuff from it. This was one. This was part of... that was part of a Stations of the Cross.
Mm.
And over here I have the crucifix that came from the church. Where is it? Here. This crucifix, all of this is my altar for the dead. All of the people here are dead. And I say my prayers every night, and I bring them all together. That's my father in the Indian Army, and my mother, and my brothers, and all of these are dead. And this was in my old church in Ireland, which was built in 1829 at the time of Catholic emancipation. And everybody in Capel White on Good Friday would have kissed this cross for over nearly 200 years. And so, I treasure this and I keep it here on my little altar with all of my ancestors. And let's see, here is, this is, this is the nursing home in Tipperary where my mother died. I have pictures of my mother, my brother, two brothers who have died. This is from my grandmother's house in Capel White. And I light it every night and pray for my dear grandmother.
How old is that, do you know?
Oh, Lord, I don't know. How old was my grandmother? she was born the day of Gettysburg.
Wow.
Okay. So it's quite old.
All right.
Yes.
Great.
Maybe you've got enough stuff.
I think that's fantastic. Thank you so much. We'll pack things up and I'll stop.